right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate.
That's right.
Back again.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a very good show today, and it's one that I've been really trying to figure out how to do because, you know, as everybody knows who's been listening to this show, I'm a major supporter of the fight against mass incarceration, and I'm a major supporter of the October 22nd National Day of Protest against police terror, you know, and the criminalization of a generation. And I'm not going to joke with you. And that's what this show is dedicated to.
At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in 2003. And the speech is found on a DVD called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. You can get access to that full DVD if you go to revolutiontalk.net. All right. And we're going to be listening to a particular piece he did around the role of the police in the society. And before that, we'll be talking with Amina, and Amina's from the Revolution Club in Los Angeles. And she's just recently returned from Ferguson, Missouri, and has been busy working on the fight against police brutality, as well as the fight to change the entire world, to change the entire world through revolution. So stay tuned for that one.
Opening the show up, I have to tell you, I'm really glad. I kind of fell into this one because publicist David Magdal wrote me an email, and he said, Michael, you've got to have this guy on your show. And I said, all right, I trust David. And I thought, okay. And he sends me a link to the film and he says, watch this. And I watched it and I thought, David, I got to have this guy on my show. And I'm really glad I did. We're going to be talking with Darius Clark Monroe. He's the filmmaker of a film called Evolution of a Criminal, in which he asks the question, how does a 16-year-old honor student evolve into a bank robber? And he asked this question about himself, all right? And it's a film that brings forward a lot of the issues that we talk about all the time, economic injustice, poverty, race, and the importance of family in a moving and insightful way. Darius, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, and I'm going to jump right into it. Tell people what the film is about.
So Evolution of a Criminal is an autobiographical feature-length documentary, and it's about I wanted to explore how, as a 16-year-old kid, I got involved in a bank robbery, into a bank robbery. And it explores just some of the systemic reasons and the personal reasons that really pushed me to make such a rash choice at that age. And you really see how just that one decision just had a ripple effect on my family, my immediate family, my extended family, my community, as well as the customers inside of the bank.
Mm-hmm. You know, but that's the story on one level. But it is a story told about an individual, yourself, and the people that were with you, your friends at the time. And you're 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, I can think back when I was 16 and I was a knucklehead, okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, a whole lot of people, you do a lot of things like, you know, it's like stick your hand in the fire. And, oh, I didn't mean to do that, but I can't stop myself.
Right? Yeah.
But there's a whole thing. You're a kid, you know? And so you did something that was motivated by something that was much bigger than yourself, though. It wasn't just being crazy.
Not at all.
Yeah, go ahead, talk about that.
No, you know what the thing is? I just, at that age, I was working part-time job. My mom had a full-time job, and my stepfather had a full-time job and a part-time job. And we were, you know, we had a home. We, I had clothes on my back. We had a roof over our head. But I just couldn't figure out why. It just always felt like we were stuck. It just seemed like we just could not get just over the hump of just being moving forward in class. And, you know, I was always of the belief that, you know, we could work hard and have some type of access to this American dream, but it didn't seem like a reality. And my parents were stressed out. And so even though I would have conversations with my mom about our finances, I could just feel it in the air. It was tenuous. I could feel that things were just not going well. And right shortly after my birthday, our home was burglarized. And that was just demoralizing. And I just felt like, you know, one more situation could really push us into a place that just was really destitute. I just thought, well, you know what? I'm not going to go rob someone else's home. But I knew at the time that banks were FDIC insured. And I thought, you know, after watching an episode of America's Most Wanted, you know what? I'm going to do this bank robbery because I felt like we needed an immediate infusion of support. Yeah, again, I was a teenager, but I really wanted to do something that could, you know, help right then and there. And I rationalized it in my head. And I planned this robbery with my best friend next door neighbor, another guy, and we did it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy because you're sitting in and I'm thinking, okay, you know, it's like I could see myself saying, you know, hey, FDIC insured, nobody's going to lose anything. But it wasn't just, you know, it was the fact that you were doing this out of something because something of a really perceived and often felt need. And I mean, and people should know, you, it's in Houston, Texas, mm-hmm. you know, which is a rough area anyway for anybody. I mean, mm-hmm. I just, you know, I'm amazed at how many people get criminalized in Texas alone, you know, which is, it seemed like it's a steady every day. If you, and especially if you're black or brown, there's mm-hmm. somebody in your family or many, many times, many people in your family who are going to have some familiarity with the legal system and incarceration.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm looking at that and I'm looking at this sweet kid. Who says you? Who says who's here's his mom and dad talking about the troubles they got. You know, we're gonna lose the house. We're gonna do this. We're gonna do that. We can't pay the note. You know, how are we gonna get the hell? And you know, parents oftentimes talk about that stuff, and sometimes even talk in a way that either you overhear or you just hear it. You overhear it, or they talk to you sometimes, mm-hmm. just trying to work stuff out. And I was really moved by the fact that throughout the film, there was something you kept making. Your moms kept talking about, your dad kept talking about, and you talked about it. That there was, you did feel this pressing need to step up and be the one. You could do something more than just be this sweet little kid that was mm-hmm. like, you know, doing good in school and hanging out and whatever, you know, may have had a future or may not have had right. a future, you know, or may have had a different future than what anybody thought. So, you know, that was something that really moved me in the course of this, because it was something that was done and planned out. And I have to give you credit. It was a damn good plan. you got that from America's Most Wanted. All right, man, that idea. Yeah. Okay.
Which is so odd, right? Yeah. Which is so odd.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. When you look back on this, because people should know too that you did this film many years.
Yeah, seven years in the making.
Well, 7 years in the making, but also many years after you ended up going to jail.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, you did a 5-year bid, right?
I was fortunate enough in Texas to get 5 years, and mm-hmm. I did 3 years of the five. Mm-hmm. And then I started working on this film 10 years after I was incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, what made you actually step back and say, okay, I got to make this film?
You know, it was actually a really strange and odd experience. I was, you know, in the third year in the grad program at NYU, and I was actually standing inside of a bank. And while standing inside of a bank, I had a panic attack because I was standing in line and I looked out the window and I thought someone looked like they were going to come and rob it. It was like someone had walked by the glass, and I said that, you know, looks like someone may come in here and rob this place. And I don't know if that was real or not. It didn't happen. But I've always felt, since I was involved in my own robbery, that just karmically I would be a victim, that I would be victimized. Right then, that moment in Manhattan, just my heart broke because I was having this panic attack, but I knew exactly what it was coming from. And it was because I just really, at no point did I ever really reconcile what I had done to those people in that bank. And instantly, I just felt like I want to go meet these people. I want to go talk to them, and I want to hear this side of the story. I would also like to apologize for my actions, because it just wasn't who I was. And even though I was going into this institution to get this money, I didn't realize at 16 that, you know, there were going to be people inside of the bank who would be impacted by my choice. And that sort of just spurred the idea of wanting to make this film.
Now, one thing that really struck me too is you had the audacity to want to go up and, hi, my name is Darius.
Yeah.
You were in the bank the day I robbed it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. And that could be dangerous in Texas.
I was thinking about that.
That could be a very dangerous
right.
thing.
That's
very
right.
dangerous
yeah.
thing.
Yeah. So how did that work out for you, Ben?
You know, a few people, you know, I was fortunate enough that a lot of people wanted to talk. Most declined being involved in the finished film, but people wanted to talk. First, I was terrified because I didn't know if someone was going to show up at the door with a gun and, you know, push me off of their property. But once, you know, people just allowed me to get a few lines out and they could see that I was genuine, they would step out the house and they would talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell that they were still, it was amazing that I wasn't the only one wrestling with this. They were still trying to process what had happened, because the moment I started to hear them speak, it's like time had just collapsed. We went right back to that place, and the same level of terror and all of the emotions that were bubbling through them during the robbery, I felt it standing across from them, and it shook me up because I was like, wow. One of the women who were inside of the bank, she was the same age as my mom, and she reminded me of my mom, her whole reaction, and I just couldn't really believe that I did it. It was crazy, but I would say the experience was also really healing. It was really healing to have that exchange.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. You're listening to my conversation with Darius Clark Monroe. He's the filmmaker of a film called Evolution of a Criminal, in which he asks the question, how does a 16-year-old honor student evolve into a bank robber? All right, and this is a really great film. You've got to see this. It's really going to make you think. It's going to challenge a lot of, even a lot of like pre preconceived notions that people have about who does what to who in society and who, where does this all come from and all this stuff. So it's a very interesting film. And it actually, it was executive produced by Spike Lee, which is actually pretty, you know, pretty interesting for a first time filmmaker. Who, all right, so you were the teacher's pet at NYU, right?
I was not, no.
Just joking, no, man, no, just no. joking, yeah. But here's the thing, when you're talking about this point about going up and you know, having this engagement with these people, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that I noticed that, you know, you talk in here and you, in some of the notes that you sent out with the film, and what I was thinking about as I watched the film, you talk about, you didn't want this to be sort of just a, yeah, I did it. You didn't want it to be, you know, and you wanted to actually have a film that was, that mind the gray areas mm-hmm. that people couldn't look at it and say, well, you were wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And people also couldn't say, well, I would have done it. I, you know, there was not the sort of making the hero, nor was there making the devil out of yourself and your friends. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit because it's very important. Because when you, even when you're looking at all the people you talk to, including members of your family, you know, I think it's your uncle and then and your aunt, and yeah. they're all sitting there and they're talking. And your aunt in particular said, "Well, he shouldn't have. He did this." And she goes, "Well, you know, when I was in jail."
Right, right, right. And because again, the whole point of the one aspect of the film, especially as a filmmaker and being involved in this, was to subvert expectations because people hold on to their own idea of who or what a criminal is. And I, and for the, you know, a lot of the film, you see my aunt and uncle talk, and you've come to know them, and then in the third act. They reveal, you know, I've also, you know, my uncle was like, I was a 3-time loser. My aunt said, I also was in prison. And it's like, whoa, you didn't look like someone who went to prison. But again, it's like, what does that look like? What does that look like?
Let's talk about that because that's something you pose very sharply. And what does it look like? And you said, you know, does it look like this cute guy with chubby cheeks and, mm-hmm. You know, 300 pounds and chunky, mm-hmm. chubby cheeks? Does that, do I look like a criminal? Is that what I, and because I'm black or brown, you know, whatever, is that, does that make me a criminal?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
No, it is. This film, for some audience members, I can tell has been tough because they have been holding on to some preconceived notion for quite a long time. And the thing is, people are comfortable with the stat. You know, when you say, well, 2 million people are incarcerated in this country, or, you know, this percentage of black people are incarcerated, it just becomes just this generic blanket. I wanted to put a face behind one of those numbers. And I wanted people to see that these are human beings. And that most of the people most of the people who I was locked up with, I'm not an anomaly. These are people who had hope, who had dreams, who had goals, who were caught up in the muck and mire of a very dangerous and oppressive system. It's easy to try to just, you know, well, it's out of sight, out of mind. They're not real. But when people come to understand that, oh, these folks care, they have compassion, you know, they're complicated people, I think it's hard for them to just grapple with the reality that we're locking up real people, that there are no boogeymen. And of course, there are some folks who may be deranged and may have psychological issues, but overwhelmingly, these are people who had no interest in being involved in the system when they were born. There was no pathology, there was no genetic disorder that led them into a life of crime, that there were situations and circumstances that pushed them into a corner that we try to run away from as a society. And when you talk about class and race, it gets really, really difficult for people to have that discussion. People just want to continue moving through life, ignoring a lot of the deficits of this country and of this planet. For me, the film is to explore the ugliness, to get into that gray area, for people to see that we are way more complex mm-hmm. than we give ourselves credit for.
I was thinking about that in relation to your friend Pierre, mm-hmm. and he's the guy, and we'll talk about that, mm-hmm. is special circumstances with him yeah. in terms of what happened to him. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, and your other friend as well, I mean, did your other friend end up doing some time beyond?
He did, Trey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. yeah. But then just the life that people have, and you look at it, as I was saying, and you were mentioning all these people you come to know that were in prison. You know, there is a point here about genocide. Mm-hmm. There is a point about a slow genocide that's happening. And sometimes, and a slow genocide doesn't stay slow all the time. And a
right.
big aspect of that is this mass incarceration where you have over 2 million people in jail, more than half of that are black or brown. And oftentimes they're for nothing. My wife was pointing out something in the paper today. There was a man who spent 16 years in jail. He finally gets out. And because, why does he get out? He gets out because turns out he didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And the cops sort of made up his story like they did with the Central Park Five. They kind of just fed him things to say. He was a 16-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. Maybe he did 30 years in jail. That's what it was. He was a 16-year-old kid. He did 30 years in jail. And he ends up, they let him go saying, well, geez, you didn't do it. You know, because they have records now. The cops telling him what to say. And then they find out there were all kinds of inconsistencies in what he said, even about what he described. And you're thinking how many times that gets played over. And even in your case, I mean, you guys, look, face it, man, you guys were only kids. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing. You know, you were kids. And this system slammed down on you hard enough to, I mean, yes, you're lucky you got the 5 years, but, you know, as you said, you could have gotten 99 years,
yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And that's a heavy thing, because you look at that, and then you look at your friend Pierre, what's happened to him in society is actually more common than not.
Oh, know? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, a lot of times people are just, you know, they watch the film, and they're like, well, you're so articulate. But Pierre, you know, what happened? And, you know, when I see Pierre, I see a dude with a huge heart, and I also see somebody who had been allowed to slip through the cracks repeatedly. Whether it was at school, whether it was outside of school, whether it was in the home, Pierre was allowed to fall through the cracks. And the dangerous thing about it in this country as a young black man, if you are allowed to slip through the cracks, you can end up in a very, very bad and difficult place. And I'm not giving too much away, but Pierre, you know, when he talks about in the film that he was heavy, you know, that he was questioned, he says questioned, but I'm thinking back about the fact that he was a 16-year-old kid and he was heavily interrogated repeatedly. They didn't interrogate me. I didn't get arrested. You know, I never spoke to the detectives until the day I was arrested. I had no idea they had been interviewing Pierre prior to that. But the fact that, you know, he had two grown-ups, his parents had no idea, there was no legal representation there, and they were constantly interrogating him, I'm sure he may have given up some information.
And the thing is, exactly the point, that, again, it goes back to how many times we've seen this, the Central Park Five, other kids that get picked up. You know, yourself. I mean, all this stuff. Although I do have to say, man, Pierre was one of those cats that, you know, as I'm watching the film, I'm thinking, all right, I knew. I did some bad stuff when I was a kid, but I knew. I look at him and said, that brother's going to be trouble.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I said, Darius, what the hell got into you?
Yeah.
You had to find somebody better than that, man. Yeah, yeah. But that's the point, is that you were three kids.
Yeah.
And this idea of painting you as ruthless, incorrigible monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And even you know, when I listened to the prosecutor, you know, and I know you were trying to talk about that stuff about compassion coming in. But, you know, look, this same prosecutor that let you slip through the cracks to a certain extent, you know, that 5 years is not really slipping through the cracks. Mm-hmm. 5 years in prison is not, and in Texas, not a walk in the sunshine.
No.
Yeah. And so the thing is, and you even say this, actually, I thought that was very heavy. You talked about one of the things that really struck you when you were in prison is you got there and you started working in a cotton field.
Oh, yeah.
You were a black man in Texas, a black child in Texas working in a cotton field. What did that concentrate for you?
Woo. It was too much. It was almost as if someone had just pulled the curtain back to really, really show me exactly what this whole, when you talk about genocide and the prison industrial complex, it just showed me. I was like, this is insane. I said, because I don't know. I couldn't figure out why we were out there, what we were doing, and if it was just to break us as human beings. Because it's I understand the history of this country and I understood what had happened, but I never thought I would be picking cotton. And when I was out there and to actually do it and think about my ancestors and think about there were just so many thoughts that ran through my mind. And I said, this doesn't feel random. This feels like it's very controlled and plotted out and planned to be exactly the way it is. Like I said, it was defeating to be out there to pick that cotton. I couldn't, like I said, it's something even now I can't believe that it still goes on, that people do that. And you would think just from a historical standpoint that they would have some type of compassion, like, well, maybe this is really, really messed up. We shouldn't allow this. But Texas in this country is what it is. Make no mistake, and people who think that there is no direct line from slavery to the prison industrial complex are sadly mistaken, because it is another form of slavery. It is another form of slavery. It's legalized. It's right there in the open, and everyone wants to ignore it, but it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, and this idea of charging children as adults, mm-hmm. and it's constant, and it's increasing. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at 16-year-old kids always getting charged as adults, mm-hmm. and they say because of the heinous nature of the crime, and you're thinking, wait a minute, man, what the— There's 16-year-old kids. Clearly, they need help. But this is a system overall that doesn't have any use, frankly, for black people in the society. Mm-hmm. And its answer is, we are going to, you know, this genocidal thing is the plan they got. You know, started with Nixon and the war on drugs, all the stuff, the way they devastated communities, and mm-hmm. then the mass incarceration. Just incredible. Now, I wanted to ask you something, too, because this will have to be our last question. As much as I could talk to you for an hour, man. Yes. You said this thing about that, and in the film you showed this, where you go to your professors at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this, basically, you say, look, man, this is my film. This is my, you know, this is this. And you tell them what it's about. And they're all shocked.
Yeah.
And some of them are even saying, I wouldn't have talked to you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have recommended you for this, you know. And you're thinking about this. And you pose this question in relation to people say, come up to you often and they say, you don't look like a criminal. I know you spoke about that a little bit in the beginning of the interview, but let's revisit that because that was very heavy, especially when it came to, you know, your professors who knew you at NYU, and then they're saying, I'm glad you didn't show me this before you did it.
Because we would have judged you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, a lot of times I'm just going to just, that scene in the film, what people don't realize is that when my professor says that, you know, had I known, you know, you wouldn't have, you know, been a GA. People don't, you know, if you understand NYU and how expensive it is, and a GA ship is a full scholarship, it's healthcare, it's also, you get paid every 2 weeks to work in one of the departments, that impacts your quality of life. You know, I'm a student like any other student, working hard, I apply for this thing, and yet you would still judge me based on something that happened when I was 16. What's interesting is that people just truly don't understand just how it's not just, you know, you do your time, you do your time and you're supposed to serve it and become a productive citizen. But we live in a very judgmental society, very harsh society. And people really don't want to create a space for folks who have infractions on their record, whether they're doing, you know, well or not. People don't want to give that compassion. And it doesn't really matter how hard you work at it. The moment someone finds out that you've been involved in the criminal justice system, they want to slam, you know, this. Oh, you know, you're a thug. You're not a good person. Hopefully this film is trying to challenge that. Because again, like I said earlier, there really is no, there's, when you think of crime, there's no look, there's no makeup. And what's so fascinating is that a lot of times people instantly think about somebody black or brown, but it's like, look at how many criminals work at Bank of America, work at Citibank, Sally Mae, work at these huge gas companies, fracking companies. A lot of them are white men. A lot of them wear suits. A lot of these men work in Wall Street. They work at Halliburton, Schlumberger. And it's like, but that's the last thing you think of when you hear criminal. And yet we know from the history of this country and from what's been happening in the last decade or so, how often crimes are done at the top.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't have to watch America's Most Wanted to make out the plans.
No.
They're actually producing America's Most Wanted. There you go. But the thing is that they also, and this is extremely important because it is, you come out of the prison and it's not just that how people are looking at you, it's how the people who are on top are looking at you, but how the whole system actually, look, you read Michelle Alexander's book and people live, that new Jim Crow is a reality for people who go to prison, for black people who go to prison in particular, you know, and that's a reality. No voting rights, you know, for many people, you know, that you can't get jobs, you're all kinds of rights.
Can't get housing.
Can't get housing, all this stuff. This is exactly why people have got to get involved and stop this. Put a big stop sign up in front of all this, all right? And I'm doing this because I love the film, but also because this is the month of resistance, you know, the month of resistance against police terror, the month of resistance against the criminalization of black and brown people, the month of resistance against repression, all of this. Now, I want to thank Darius Clark Monroe for being on the show today.
Thank you.
And for making the film, brother. And I want to tell people, it's a documentary. It's called Evolution of a Criminal. It's a very, very heavy, very good film. Darius, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Teddy, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Our Lord, grant us good in this world and good in the life to come keep us safe from the torment of the fire. As we keep our hands up high and scream for justice. Ferguson, rest in peace Mike Brown, and all the young soldiers out there. God help us. Time to take a stand and save our future. Like we all got shot, we all got shot. Throwing up our hands, don't let them shoot us. Cause we all we got, we all we got. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered, it's murder. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered, it's murder. Don't put your weapons at me. Seen the pictures, feel the pain. Scandalous how they murder son. Tired of them killing us. I'm on my way to Ferguson. Talk to Tip, I talk to Diddy. Then my brother's walking with me. Mother's crying, stop the riots. We ain't got a chocolate city. I seen cold. All right, welcome back. And I tell you what, you listen to that, and I don't know if people understand how significant this is. This is a lot of these rappers that everybody says, man, they never talk about. Nothing significant. You know, it's 2 Chainz. It's The Game got up in there. Rick Ross, all these people, Diddy. They all got up in there and they made this song called Don't Shoot. This is a very powerful song, a very beautiful song. You know, if you listen to this show regularly, you know that we're in the middle of and moving up towards the end of a month of resistance, against mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And we're coming up on, or actually by the time people hear the show, we actually would have already had October 22nd. the National Day of Protest Against Police Terror, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And it's a day when all over the country, people come out and they go into the streets and they say, we're not going to live like this anymore. And joining us today to talk about all this is Amina. Amina's from the Los Angeles Revolution Club, and she just recently returned from Ferguson, and she's been working on building October 22nd, and so she's been right in the middle of all this upheaval around fighting police brutality and more, fighting for a whole better world. Amina, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about this. Maybe we'll start with Ferguson. You went to Ferguson for what was called Ferguson Weekend. Can you explain to people what that was and why you went?
Ferguson October was a weekend of resistance called by many different organizations, including the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And I went down there because there was a call for everybody to come down to Ferguson, Missouri. And leading into it, I knew that there were going to be a lot of youth and a lot of students that were going to be in Ferguson. And given that that's been a focus of a lot of what I've been doing around students and campuses for this month of resistance, I thought there is no other place I should be but down in Ferguson, Missouri for this weekend of resistance.
Well, I remember you telling me at one point, you said that, you know, you started to think about that, but then you also found that there were so many people that were planning to go there and that you felt it could make a real difference if you went. And I'd ask you about that because there was, when you say you talked to a lot of students, give people an idea because, you know, look, we're very used to right now. This is not obviously the 1960s or even the 1980s during the anti-apartheid movement. This is a different time period, and it's things that I think I get a sense that things are shifting. Big things are in the making, I think. And that's not a guarantee it's going to happen, but they're out there and you can feel it. And one of the things I remember you telling me was that you really felt that there was something different happening among a lot of the students that you were talking to. Can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important that we even know of where Ferguson, Missouri is because there has been a lot of defiance for the past 50 plus days since the murder of Mike Brown of youth, both high school student age and then college student age, who've been in Ferguson, who've been in the area, who've really kind of begun to take a stand against the unjust murder of Michael Brown. And you know, I think a lot of people have seen the picture from Howard University of a whole auditorium filled with predominantly black students with their hands up, don't shoot. And there's pictures coming out of Columbia University with fist up, don't shoot. So there's a mood shift amongst a whole generation, I feel, that are really kind of confronting that reality of what it meant for Mike Brown to be shot down, murdered, left on the street for 4.5 hours, and really have had just enough of it, and are really taking a stand and are modeling something for, I feel, a whole section of society, whole people, of really having, not just confronting that, but acting. And I feel like that's sort of what was coming into the mix, both into Ferguson October and why it was being called for everybody across the country to come down. But then it's also sort of, you know, what's opened up insofar as a whole generation really not being okay with the unjust murder of black and brown youth at the hands of the police.
You know, it's interesting because when you're saying that, I kept thinking about, okay, and they've also been talking about most recently what the authorities, what the system's been talking about. All of a sudden, we're being given the privilege of hearing how the cop who killed Mike Brown is saying, I feared for my life. And he's explaining that Mike Brown jumped into the car, into the window of the car and was wrestling for his gun and I feared for my life. Mm-hmm. Still doesn't explain how Mike Brown walked away from the car, was walking away from the car. The cop gets out of the car. Mike Brown is nowhere near him. And he's still saying, I feared for my life. And then he blew Mike Brown away. Mm-hmm. Now you think about that because it says so much about exactly this, the genocidal edge of things in relation to brown and black youth, in relation to brown and black people, but in particular, the focus on a lot of these youth. And I kept thinking about it as I was thinking about this thing of, you know, you had a phenomenon of Black Ivy and all these black students from Ivy League schools and from the top schools, in the country. And you had them people who, you know, in what the system always says to them is, look, you made it through. You can have a decent life. But I think there was something that happened here when people saw that the lives of black and brown people don't mean anything to this system.
Yeah, I mean, I just came from a classroom presentation at a local university here. And one of the questions that one of the students asked was, what about all the violence from the protesters? And I go, well, let's set the record straight here. Actually, the violence was predominantly coming from the police. And I feel in this point that you raised about the vast majority of people who are shot and murdered by the police are running away or are not posing any threat. And I feel like that reality, you know, amongst a lot of different students, like you mentioned, the Black Ivy Coalition, which frankly put out a call. These are students from Harvard, from University of Pennsylvania, from Princeton. And they put out a call and said, are we going to be the generation that's going to put a stop to the violence against people of color? And, you know, you've had different Ivy League schools take up these mock shoes. I think this point about a genocidal program, these mock shoes, these 7x9 spaces that have really, you know, 23 out of the 24 hours a day occupied in the last hour being left empty to represent the 1 hour a day that people get out in the yard, that prisoners get out in the yard. I mean, this is torture. And so this has been some of the mood and the shift that people have been acting on throughout this whole overall month of resistance.
Now tell people, what is a shoe? Because a lot of people listening in other parts of the country may have no idea what a shoe is. They might be thinking you're talking about a shoe that you put on your foot, but it's actually something really insanely cruel. So why don't you tell people what a shoe is?
So a shoe is a solitary housing unit. And so 7x9 is the actual space of these solitary housing units. And so you have over 80,000 people, as we speak, who are in these shoes. And so what these campuses did, this is torture. I mean, torture on international level, on an international standard. So what these campuses have done, Princeton, Harvard, Columbia, UCLA, UC Riverside, what these campuses have done, they've done mock shoes. And so they pretty much, as simple as just putting chalk down, chalking a 7x9 space, or putting an actual prison, a mock prison space, and they have occupied these spaces for 23 out of the 24 hours. And one of the biggest thing that came out from some of these students at one of these campuses was the shock of how little this space actually is, and not even having a clue as to the fact that this is the daily reality of thousands of people in this country.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Amina from the Los Angeles Revolution Club, and she has been out organizing against police brutality and for revolution all over the country, just recently returning from Ferguson, Missouri. Now, tell me this. When you went to Ferguson, let's talk about some of the highlights of the time that you were there.
There were a lot. I would say a couple of things. One, you know, talking about, since we're talking about students and campuses, there was a march, I think, that started like at midnight and went straight into maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, if not beyond that, that ended up going into the University of St. Louis and filled a whole public square. And I think at one point there were a lot of the chants got changed to out of your dorms and into the streets. And there was a lot of impact that I felt it had on the campus overall, but then even amongst the people who were part of this demonstration. It was very, very, very significant and important. And the repression of the police was very, you had these cops like tapping on their boots as a way of threatening a lot of the people who had come out to the streets.
Explain that. What do you mean tapping on your boots?
Well, you had them lined up and you had with their clubs in almost in uniform synchronized way tapping their clubs on their boots, like beating it step by step as a form of threat. But, you know, overall there was a real defiance that I think captured the overall weekend. And then you had, you know, this walked into Moral Monday, which was a day where everybody was wanting to get arrested. You had a lot of the religious forces. I mean, Cornel West started his speech the night before. I'm not here to give a speech, I'm here to get arrested, or something along those lines. And that was really the kind of the mood. People went into Walmarts, which was a place where John Crawford was shot and murdered by the police for having a fake BB gun in the gun department of Walmart. And then the police, without any questions, just shooting him down. And this was sort of a symbolic way in which a lot of people down in Ferguson actually took to these to three Walmarts across the area to do an act of civil disobedience, or going into City Hall and dropping banners and requesting and demanding that one of the representatives of the City Hall come and speak to these protesters, and, you know, and had a list of demands and said, if you don't meet our demands, we will be back here in 2 days.
So tell me this now, and we're rushing a little bit, and I have one question I'm going to ask you at the end, but I want to, and I think we have time for maybe two more questions. So one of them is, how does this play over now? Now, you left Ferguson. You were deeply involved with this, and there's all this activity going on in Ferguson. Yet you come back, and you're continuing to build for October 22nd and the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And you talk about that. Did people then move from, like, Ferguson to making expressions of actually, yeah, we're going to continue this. We're going to be out in the street for October 22nd.
Yeah, Ferguson October announced that their next step is October 22nd. And there has been a quite an important turnaround from a lot of these campuses, including from high school students calling for walkouts. A lot of these campuses saying, look, we're going to meet at a public area and then we're going to go to a local demonstration, or we're going to go ourselves and have some kind of demonstration here on our campus. So this has been very significant and important, talking about over two dozen schools at this point, predominantly high school students. And then you're talking about over, I think the last count I saw was over 80 cities across the country, different forms of actions that are happening. So this is very important, both, you know, Ferguson October and the kind of atmosphere it opened up, but then also what needs to continue moving forward of really having a shift overall throughout society around mass incarceration and all of its genocidal consequences throughout this month of October.
Now, one of the questions I'll ask you, the final question I'll ask you is this. I remember, back when there was a lot, when society was like in a lot of upheaval, whether it was around apartheid or whether before that around Vietnam or about the fighting against the oppression of black people, all that happened in the 60s and the 70s. And then you had the 80s with apartheid and other things that went on, over the years. In these kinds of periods, there's always this big debating among the people who are taking part about what are we doing? What connection does it have with actually changing the world? How can we change the world? What's it going to look like? Now, you went down there as part of the Revolution Club of Los Angeles, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're clearly not going down and saying, I'm here to talk nice about voting. You say you went down as a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to know, because this has been a big thing, a big point of debate in relation to Ferguson, was outside agitators, people bringing revolution and trying to corrupt our struggle. What was it like down there when people found out that you were revolutionary? And how are you looking at that? How's revolution relate to what's happening in Ferguson?
One of the biggest lessons that I grabbed out of the whole weekend, or that I got throughout the whole weekend, was, there was a lot of call for like a new civil rights movement or a new sort of movement of resistance. And as I was walking through and as I was discussing with a lot of people, I mean, late into the night or pre-planned programming, where does the oppression of black people come? How do we get free? How do we break free? All these different questions. I mean, the main thing I was able to really kind of strengthen, both in my understanding and then overall for others, was how much actually what we need is a movement for revolution that's about fundamentally and radically changing the world. And really, there's been so much that has been learned since the times of the 60s. And frankly, because a lot of the work of Bob Avakian and the Revolutionary Communist Party has done in really kind of summing up that whole first stage of communist revolution would really unleash the whole movement of resistance in this country. And then what happened since then? What were the openings that caused? But then also, what were the shortcomings and errors? And I feel like a lot of that for this generation, there is a real question of, what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of people are we going to be? And what's our lives going to be about? And, and it's very controversial. I think in light of all the people who, coming from wherever they're coming from, either want to keep things settled in as is or try to elect this or that candidate, I think it's a question that people have to ask. What is it unsettling when people who say that they want to be free attack revolutionaries who are fighting for a whole different way forward for humanity? And I think there's a real call for people to be principled and for really discussing on a very principled level, look, what's the problem confronting humanity and what's the solution? And if there are disagreements with, this new synthesis of communism, with revolution, with all that stuff, which people raised, and rightly so, what about the first stage of communist revolution? What about Mao? Those, I think, are very principled questions. But if it's just outright attack, I think there's so much that's weighing on humanity for there to be such pettiness. And then, frankly, you have a real state, as we have seen what they do to Mike Brown, what they do to countless others, that is vicious by nature. And no room and no ounce should be left open for that. So as a last plug, I do want to make a plug that people come to New York City on November 15 and be a part of this historic dialogue between Bob of Aiken and Cornel West, revolution and religion, the fight for emancipation, and the role of religion. And people can find out more about that at revcom.us.
All right, again, that was revcom.us. Amina, thank you very much for joining us today. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Amina from the Los Angeles Revolution Club, and we've been talking about her experience in Ferguson and fighting to change the world, to bring on a whole new way of living. All right, we're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
I'm in denial, and it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go, and it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no, and all we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off me.
Welcome back. That was Be Free from J. Cole. You know, that was such a beautiful song, such a powerful song. I'm just going to keep playing that as often as I can because it's so powerful, so beautiful, and because it says so much about the times we're in today. And that's what this next segment of the show is going to be speaking to in a very powerful way as well, and an even more powerful way in a different way as well. And we're going to be listening to an excerpt from a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in 2003. And the title of that speech was Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this is a section that is drawn from where Avakian speaks about the role of the police in society. And it's a killer section, and it explains a whole hell of a lot about what's going on in the world today, particularly in relation to the genocidal assaults on Black and Latino people all across this country. So check this out. Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
Today, it is mostly the police who openly, as the police, carry out brutality and terror against Black youth and Black people in general. Applying that author's statement on lynching to the present, we could put it this way. It is doubtful that there is a young Black male growing up in the U.S. today, in the South or the North, who does not have a very real fear of being brutalized or even murdered by the police. And again, this touches all Black people. Another book on the history of lynching of Black people in the South makes this point, and think about this. Black parents learn to fear more for some sons than for others. Those who were surly, who had attitude, who were rebellious or were careless, who had not learned the art of appearing to know their place, they were in greater danger. And tragically, parents had no choice but to try to keep their sons especially from showing those qualities like self-confidence, curiosity, ambitiousness, that could be interpreted as insolence or arrogance by white people. However, this author goes on to say, there was only so much that could be done by the parents in trying to prevent disaster. Any unlucky circumstance could instantly put a Black man at deadly risk. And today we see the same thing. In our party's work in the housing projects, one of the most heartrending things we've learned is how Black mothers in the projects start to worry early on if the boys that they've given birth to start to show that they might grow up to be large. Because then they'll have everything come down on them that comes down on a large Black male. Think of what this means, that a mother from the time her child is 2 or 3 years old has to worry that he might grow up to be too big, so he might be seen to be a threat by the police and then cut down and murdered brutally by them. What kind of a society? What kind of a system is this? Now, in this talk, I'm going to be using the words society and system a lot. By society, I mean a group of people who come together or are brought together for common aims and purposes. And in particular, I mean a society on the level of a country, where people live in a territory together and have the same government, like the United States or Brazil or Egypt or China. By system, I mean an organized way that something is held together and works. Systems have a certain order to them and certain ways in which things are done. Sometimes this is set down in formal rules and regulations or even laws, and sometimes it's just something that everybody has learned and carries out without the need for laws and people assigned to enforce them. For example, a game of cards or dominoes is a system. You have to play these games a certain way or it won't work. You can't put a domino any old place you want, any time you want, and try to think the game's gonna work. What the f*** are you doing, man? And the same is true of a game of cards, a bid whist, spades, or poker. You can't just play any card you want, any time you want, or else you've broken the system and the thing won't work. The same is true of a game like basketball, which is organized in a different way than, let's say, football. You can't just take the ball and run down the court with it in basketball. You have to dribble it or pass it. And in soccer, you can't use your hands unless you're the goalie. Soccer has a different system. A song also has a system. It has certain notes and musical patterns and rhythms. And it often has certain lyrics. If you don't sing the right lyrics or sing the right tune, then you're not singing that song. Or maybe you're not singing at all. Human societies are organized into systems too. As I will get into through the course of this talk, different societies throughout history have been organized into different systems. And at this stage of human history, there is the possibility to bring into being a radically different society with a radically different system. Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police, how you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He talked about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, "I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident." You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. "Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale?" This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely, and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, "God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up." They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Look what happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A. They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off.
Okay, that's the end of one segment of the speech by Bob Avakian, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And the segment was on the role of the police in society. And there's another piece to that that comes a little bit later that I want to run because I think it's an extremely important message. And it's particularly about the youth and what their lives are like here and what we need to do about it. All right, so check this out.
And let's talk about what this system does to the youth every day, to the future, or what's supposed to be the future of the society and the people. People without a job, youth who have no hope of a decent job, who are hanging out on the streets, looking only to something like crime to maybe give them a way to have something and get some respect. Recently, I was reading a book called Turbo Capitalism by a conservative author named Edward Luttwak. And even though he's a conservative, he made this interesting comment. He said, for millions of youth in the inner cities, even taking into account the chances that you'll get killed at a young age or go to jail for a long time, crime is a rational choice. Now think about what he's saying, this conservative author and analyst. He's saying for these youth, crime makes sense. It's the best option they have. And all the time, of course, these same people are preaching to the youth about what terrible things they're doing by doing crime. Well, what kind of system have you got then? If you can say that for millions and millions of youth in the inner city, crime is a rational choice, the best choice they can make under your system. What kind of system have you got then? Over 2 million people are in prison in this country, the majority of them young people, especially black people and Latinos. Again, I say, what kind of country, what kind of system is this where more money is spent on prisons and jails than on education for people in the inner cities? Why? What good reason is there for so many, while they are still young teenagers, to come to the conclusion that they might not live to be 18 or 21 anyway, or if they do, they will be facing a long time in prison? Look at all these beautiful children, full of life and energy, full of so much promise when they are young, and see what happens to so many of them, what this system does to them as they grow a little older. Once more, I say, what kind of society is this? What kind of system is this? No. This generation and generations to come deserve a much better future, and a much better future is possible. I say no more. No more generations of our youth here and around the world whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion even before they are born. I say no more of that.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's an excerpt on the role of the police in society, and it's tied in very much with the genocidal assault against Black and Latino people, especially the youth all across this country these days, all right? And this segment is taken from a speech called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And it's a speech that was given back in 2003, and it's available in its entirety at revolutiontalk.net. All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank all of my guests today. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, and if you want to follow us, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter. But again, do it very quietly and in a non-threatening way, or I may just start squealing and run away, okay? So check that out. Be careful and nice. And one more thing before we go. Earlier in the show, you heard Amina talk about this, and I want to pull your ear on it too. There's a dialogue coming up on November 15th in New York City, and it's going to be held at the Riverside Church, the historic Riverside Church. And it's presented by Revolution Books and the Bob Avakian Institute, all right? And the name of this dialogue is Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person. And let me tell you, folks, you have never seen or heard anything like this is going, like what this is going to be, all right? You haven't heard anything like this, a revolutionary Christian and a revolutionary communist talking about the world the way it is and why it doesn't have to be this way and how we're going to change it and what can the whole world look like, all right? So check this out. Again, that's November 15th. And it's at Riverside Church in New York City, and everybody who can get there should get there. It's a tremendous, just a very powerful dialogue, and it can change the whole tenor of this society. It can change the whole level of political discourse here, and that's something I think we really need. All right, we're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs this year, and it's from Chucky Weiss, and it's called Bomb the Tracks, and it's got a moral in the song that's well worth listening to and acting on. All right, so check that out. Talk to you again next week. Churchill, he was in Brazil. Hey, Bernice took us.